Happy again. Here we are.
Definitely. Happy to be back with you and with WBAI.
Life must be a little boring. It must be a little boring for people and for animals because they've always done something to get outside of themselves. You know, I mean, there must be something about the human condition or the animal condition that says, you know, just being the way you are is not good enough. Let's talk about goats who love caffeine. You know, they go to these caffeine plants and they've got to have it and they get high on it. And ants are addicted to nectar because they get high on nectar. Believe it or not, it's not just they collect it. They get high on it. The desire to experience altered state of consciousness is a natural drive shared by all living beings, and that animals engage in these behaviors deliberately, rejecting the Western assumption that using drugs is a negative action or the result of an illness. Animals have always searched out drugs wherever they could find it. So there are mushroom-loving reindeer. There are reindeers who trip out on mushrooms. I mean, they really do. They just don't eat mushrooms. They eat the purple mushrooms, and they get woozy. And then there's the intoxicated birds. Now, you know, as a story came out of India where some elephants broke into a grain farm and they found some, what was it they found? Grain alcohol? Beer.
Elephants
beer.
Have been known to follow routes where they know when trees give fruits that ripen on the branches and ferment and develop ethanol. And elephants every year have been seen to seek the trees with the fruits that contain the alcohol and stop by and eat the fruits until they fall on their backs, and there they stay for a couple of days.
Didn't we see a wonderful drunk?
There is a video, yes.
A video, what was it called? Drunken?
It wasn't just elephants, actually. A lot of animals know about it, and they come by and party.
Now, recently, some elephants stumbled across a supply of homemade rice beer, and they wound up going, they got alcohol crazy. You know, an alcohol crazy, which is something that happens to some people who ingest alcohol, and they stampeded and they killed a whole bunch of people, died. And then, not only that, this is in Guwahati, I guess, which is in India, and then they smashed huts and plundered granaries, and then once that happened, they went into every village looking for more casks. So now they become the great raiders. And they kill a lot of people along the way. I mean, it's just like they can't get their mind off it. It's like better than sex for them. They got to go get this alcohol.
Well, Amanda, that's interesting
because
I think that there's always the potential for such, destructive turnarounds of these things. They are very powerful substances, all the mood-altering, mind-altering substances, and there's definitely a danger involved in every myth that tells the story of one of these substances. There's going to be a dragon or some kind of a beast that has to be, dealt with before one can get to the good part of these things. But there is a good part.
Well, for example, in if you were to take some drugs like peyote or something like that, you deal with the dragon because you wind up getting sick, you vomit, you get nauseous.
Right, that's the dragon.
That's the poison. And then you get past the poisons.
It's the poisoning element is definitely part of these substances. But not the only part, thank goodness.
Right. And because it is the only part.
Because it isn't the only part.
It isn't the only part, right. So there are monkeys who, actually apes, who seem to be the first ones. They go eat the seeds of the cola trees, which contain caffeine and theobromine, and are legendary in their effect in stopping fatigue. And they not only get fatigued, but they roll all over the ground laughing and having a good time. So monkeys, you know. I mean, they some monkey must have said, you know, I think I'll sell little $5 packs of these goby seeds, you know. What are you looking for, buddy? Hey, you got any goby seeds for me? But it's true.
Like the tone.
but once it gets discovered that an animal favors a psychedelic, there's another animal who's going to be looking at that very spot to see if he could eat the animal who's going after the psychedelic, because then they're going to be vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny thing, you know, psychedelics, the idea, the word psychedelic, even the word hallucinogenic or hallucinogenic, you know, it's like a phony word. It's a...
Yeah,
it doesn't
really
represent
not.
It. Why is it not, Roberta? Why is hallucinogenics not the right word for these things?
Yes, it isn't, because hallucinations are events whereby a person sees something or someone that is not there, but the person who experiences the hallucination does not know, does not realize that what they're seeing is not there. Whereas when a person takes a mind-altering substance, they may indeed see things other than what they would normally see, or hear things, or experience different perceptual things, you know, events, but they know, they are aware that what they're seeing is not there. Did that go around too much?
No, it kind of makes sense. If you're hallucinating, you're seeing something that you believe is real that's not there.
Exactly.
So there are some times with a drug where you may become paranoid, and you become, actually, you do imagine that something is there going to hurt you. I saw dragons. I saw something crawling.
There is a difference, though, Armand. The person who is hallucinating, they really believe that the dragon is in the room. Whereas
right.
The person who is, let's say, high on LSD may indeed think that the dragon is real, but usually the person knows that they're seeing it as a result of taking the drug.
Well, you know, when people get DTs, when they're quitting, when they're trying to get off major
yes.
narcotics or alcohol, and they see snakes crawling on the wall.
Right.
I mean, they really see them.
Well, but now you're talking about DTs. That's
right.
A different thing from... having, see, you said
good.
Something at the beginning of the show. You said that people or animals take some things to get outside of themselves. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it could be maybe not outside, but maybe a bigger version of myself, whereby the things that I experience every day, if I take one of these substances, maybe I could experience 100 times as many things as I experience normally. So I think it's more, rather than going out of myself, I think it's more of maybe going deeper or wider or higher or having more of me rather than leaving myself behind.
Yeah, I understand, because I think I'm boring. You know, I think as I am, as a human put on this planet, just to function the way I function and do my job and go to sleep, and it's kind of boring. I do all kinds of things, I meaning we, do all kinds of things to enhance our relatively mundane existence.
Well, Armand, I agree with you. I would never describe you as boring, but I think most human beings experience boredom when they live their routine lives.
So we try things like we try to optimize our health.
Because we become used to what we perceive, and it's no longer a surprise.
So why do we optimize our health?
We like to be surprised. Why do we optimize our health? Oh, well, so we can experience more life.
A new level of energy. We exercise. We do creativity. We do creative things so we can step
art.
Outside of ourselves. We fall in love, because falling in love and being with another person in a relationship expands your existence. It expands your universe.
We listen to opera.
We meditate. We dance. We bungee jump.
We do all sorts of things that get us to experience more intense or more quantity and quality-wise, more of life than what we normally experience.
Now, some people spend their lives doing this. It's part of a religion. Some people go outside themselves and take psychedelic substances and drugs. And I hate the word drugs. You know, drugs,
I do too.
Isn't
I don't
it a
like
funny
it.
Word? I mean, I don't like, when we talk about taking Prozac, do we say drugs? I'm on drugs.
Well,
no, we don't. But
no, but I know what you mean. It's loaded with negative connotations.
But there is, and this is Albert Hofmann's 100th birthday, by the way.
Last year. celebrated in Basel. Albert Hofmann is the inventor of LSD, and he turned 100 years old last year, and he was there at his celebration. Lucid as can be, active. He worked into his late 90s every day, going to work on a bicycle. And, of course, he's the famous scientist because that the bicycle ride was famous because what happened was he mistakenly ingested a small amount of the substance that he was working with. He did not know he had ingested it, but he would go to work on the bike every day, on his bike, like everyone else in Switzerland. And that night, he took his bike to go home, got on the bike, started on his way, and all of a sudden, the world started to change. And that bike ride was historical. It really changed the course of history.
Amazing.
Isn't it?
You know, whenever you see the Beatles, I saw a Beatles live performance in the... And bicycles are such an important part of the acid trip experience.
I guess.
And the turning wheels.
They're very popular.
But, you know, now, in light of this, I always think that people should understand and learn about a different way of being. And here we are in New York with one way of being. We do our jobs. If some people get high, they get high. However they get high, if they drink, if they smoke a little grass, whatever they do. We have this relative New York existence. Some people go dancing and going to parties. But I thought I'd introduce the world to a different way of being. And with that, I invited someone on the air, Ed Elkin, who I've known for a long, long, long time. Ed and I used to be at conferences together. Ed, are you with us?
I am.
Oh, good, good, Ed. Could you talk as loudly as possible? Because we're going to have to project this from quite a distance. Ed, tell me about your day-to-day existence related to the use of psychedelic substances or mood-altering substances and what it's like. Just give people an idea. Here's somebody who lives in California who lives differently than we do.
Well, first of all, a caution. I'm on a wireless phone that might lose power, and if we do, I'll need you to call back in on the first line, on the main line.
Now, what happened to that handheld phone you were going to tell me about?
I'm on it now.
Oh, but it's wireless, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
So just to, you have that number, the other number, in case we lose connection. All right.
Sure.
I don't want us to lose connection. I'm delighted to reconnect with you. God, it must be about 40 years since we first met through the Association for Humanistic Psychology, and I'll never forget that amazing Princeton University event where we were all in costume, and I was doing Man of La Mancha, and you were D'Artagnan.
Exactly. It was true. Picked up by the New York Times, we did 2,000. We had a job of having to get 2,000 mental health professionals to walk 2 miles in 103-degree heat.
Mm. Oh, I don't remember the heat.
Yeah, it was very, very hot. And what Ed would do is Ed would play his role, Man of La Mancha, and I played my role as D'Artagnan, and I led the group. I had a sword and everything. It was a lot of fun.
What were you experimenting with?
No, this
that
is
time.
Not a drug thing. This is the.
No,
thing.
Actually, I was kidding, Ed.
But you're not. What psychedelic substances led to was understanding about mind manifesting, and that led me into the entire world of human potential and non-chemical ways of mind manifesting, which is what literally psychedelic means. So there is a definite connection for me, anyway. And I had my initial LSD as part of my professional research work with the United States Army, who were experimenting with LSD and other substances as incapacitating agents so that they could use them to disorient a potential enemy. And this was wonderful because you didn't have to kill someone to render them ineffective. So I thought this was a very noble way of learning about about the effects of these substances.
Shoot him, shoot him with LSD.
Well, it was, you know, it was, I believe it was drunk. And they were using, they were experimenting with aerosol systems of delivery. And it didn't really quite work effectively to make it into a weapon. But that was, it wasn't the point. The point was that that was, this year was probably around 1967, I'm guessing. 1967, 68, when I had my first exposure to pure Sandoz quality LSD. And when you say daily use, no, not anymore. long gone. Although there are substances out that are analogous. Now, what? Be more specific about
Tell me about a day. Tell me about what you live in. What kind of a commune do you live in?
Oh. Well, you met my friend. Yes, we are a shamanic performance troupe. We live at a place called the Universal Temple of Higher Consciousness.
In California, which should be.
Just outside of Escondido, California. We live in an absolutely gorgeous temple, and we call it UTHC. If you could find out about us, UTHC.TV. And we are we do performances here. We do a Friday Night Live event every Friday night.
It is a commune, right?
Well, I wouldn't call it a commune.
It's a bunch of people living together in the
five
in this
people
temple.
Unrelated. That's not quite accurate. The husband and wife are here, and as a third member of the triad, and then there are two senior people, myself and another woman, who are not in relationship.
Okay, since we're doing a show, since we're doing this program on mind expansion, what do you do as a regular thing, Ed? What have you done? What have you found the advantage of doing chemicals? What have you found? I mean, what did psilocybin do for you? What did LSD do for you? Give it to me
all
in a nutshell. All of them. What did they do? How old are you now? You're in your 60s. You're 71 years old.
Yeah.
You've been doing this for 40 years.
Approximately.
Right? What did it get you? Yes, what did it get you? What did you see?
I'm healthier, happier, and holier.
Okay.
What I do on a daily basis, almost, I do yoga. I breathe. I live in a rural area with clean water, clean air. And what the substances did was literally opened my mind to possibilities that I continue to research, nutritional ways of getting healthy, massage and body contact ways of getting healthy. The psychedelic substances led to, I would say, using maybe 40% of my mind instead of 15% of my mind.
So what you would say, and just because we don't have all that much time,
sure.
What you would say is that using the psychedelic substances, which is like Stan Grof said this as well, you open the door because there is a key, and there's a key to a certain door in your brain, and once that get open and you see a new place you could go to,
yes.
Then you spend your time after that not using the drug, but trying to go through that same door through some other means.
Yes.
Without necessarily having a chemical take you there.
Yes.
But once you know where you want to go,
yeah.
Then at least you could try to go there, because the rest of the time, you don't know that there are doors
Correct.
In your brain.
Armand, there are two metaphors briefly that I would use. One is as if you're on a two-dimensional plane and you take a substance and it takes you up off that two-dimensional plane into the air, and you have a perspective on where you were, where you are, and maybe where you're going. You come back down. You're altered in the sense that you now have a different perspective. That's one analogy. The other is if a river is all clogged with branches, what some of the psychedelic substances do, it gives you a rush of energy that cleanses the doors of perception, and your nervous system is functioning more smoothly, more efficiently than it was before because the debris has been removed.
Is there any one particular chemical that's more likely to remove debris than another? For example, would you take ecstasy versus LSD? Have they become targeted? Have you been able to use them specifically?
Different strokes for different folks. I think that the the debris cleansing function is more LSD. It really opens up the channels between your unconscious and your conscious mind, which is why it can be sometimes dangerous, because people any experiences like that should be guided, because unless you're experienced, people don't know what's in their unconscious, and they can have hallucinations, they can have paranoid experiences. But once you're an experienced traveler, then you can pretty much do it on your own. Ecstasy is totally different substances, which I don't consider a true psychedelic. Ecstasy is a entheogen and a heart chakra opener, which allows their loving feelings to expand.
Ed, one more question while I've got you here. It would seem that if you were living in a commune or a group of people in the woods somewhere in California, and you're a 71-year-old, vibrant, healthy guy who occasionally will drop a pill to just, let's have a little fun, you can't be too focused on materialism. It just doesn't seem to go together. And it seems that the group of people, there's one group of people who say mind expansion at the expense of materialism, or at the relinquishment of materialism. Would you say that that's true? Would you say that that's a reasonable assumption?
I don't think it's either or. I think you can have both. As Rajneesh and his followers proved, and there are other systems, you do not need to exchange materialism for spiritual ecstasy.
So then you must have a house and two cars and...
No. At the household, we currently have three vehicles, five people. We share much here, and we live in relative comfort with a dishwasher and washing machine, and we also meditate and do yoga.
But excess is not really important. What's important
is it's not
state
excess.
Of consciousness, right? It's not materialistic.
Correct. I would say
once
yes.
you reach that level of consciousness, I suspect, and I know you, Roberta, you may agree with me, your mind says, wait a minute, what are we doing fighting this crazy battle down here?
And how?
Mm. Yeah. Ed, thank you so much. Roberta, did you want to ask Ed something?
I could give you my email address so people could contact me if they wish.
Sure.
That's Ed Elkin, E-D-E-L-K-I-N, at AOL.com.
Great. And Roberta? Did you have a question?
No, actually, I just wanted to thank Ed. That was very interesting, and congratulations. It sounds like you have a nice life there.
Well, I started out my first 20 years in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Well, sounds great.
That was a long time ago, so I left New York in 56.
Wow.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
Hey, great to talk to you. Great to keep in touch, and congratulations on what you're doing. Blessings.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And I think that's really important. You know, Roberta, it's important to hear, because I've been, you know, to both coasts, and I've spent a lot of time in both places. And in the 60s, I was part of a whole bunch of people experimenting and trying to learn about the mind in the most intense ways. I mean, there were people like Terence McKenna, great scientist.
McKenna has done a lot of work in this.
Wonderful. Yeah, he was a mushroom specialist.
But not only that, he's a great mathematician, and he applied the mind-expanding drugs, substances, to his mathematics. And it's very interesting what came out of that.
And the scientists I've known, I knew Sasha Shulgin, mm-hmm. who invented ecstasy. Created it. He created the very first pill.
But, you know, Armand, the thing that sparked my interest the most was when I started to read how these substances have been used on and off by a lot of people to affect therapeutic goals, either in the minds of mentally ill patients or in the bodies of people who are suffering with some kind of disease or an illness, and how effective they come up to be in all the tests. So what was interesting to me was their therapeutic use, because of course I'm interested in healing in any way that can be done, and it was fascinating to read up that, you know, look at Dr. Hoffman, 100 years old, And he's been doing LSD ever since that famous bike ride. And his mind is just as brilliant and as aware as it was when he first started. So some of the things that we might believe about these substances may not be accurate. For example, the fact that they are toxic. But they can be dangerous, of course, like Ed just said, if people use them without knowing what they're dealing with, because they do bring up the unconscious. They do open the mind onto spaces that are normally closed up.
You know, I think, Roberta, it's kind of a test. I think there is a higher consciousness that's available to people. I think there's a level of consciousness, whether you do it through psychedelic drugs or not. There is a level of consciousness, expanded consciousness, that we're all invited to do. And since entheogens and psychedelics are an invitation to go there, including even alcohol. You know, you could take alcohol and expand your
Absolutely.
Mind. You really can.
Sure, tobacco.
Tobacco
can do that.
Tops the tops of tobacco.
Coffee does that. Yeah.
Now you could use that as a chemical to expand yourself, just as you could use physical health, just as you could use Mei Wang or whoever she is. Ma Wang, mm-hmm. Ma Wang, right now, Mei Wang.
Ephedra,
right? Mm-hmm. You could use all of these things to kind of get yourself to a higher place, but then this test comes in. And I think it's kind of a consciousness test. Here's the test we're going to give you. Now we'll show you that you could use your mind to expand it a little bit, and now we're going to say to you, you could use it for entertainment, or you could use it for learning. Entertainment, we're going to feed your lower chakras. We're going to give you money, sex, and power. That's the entertainment value. Or you're going to take this mind expansion and you're going to use it to a higher level, to bring your mind to a higher level. Well, the temptation, of course, is to party. And that's what people do.
And I think that that's where the guidance really comes in. Because what I have discovered in doing this research, Armand, is that these are substances that have been used ever since, for the entire duration of recorded history, but never without guidance. There was always the guidance of a shaman, a priest, a mentor, a psychologist, a doctor, someone who knew what the substance could do, knew the potential, knew how it worked, and would guide the patient, the student, the subject through that inner journey safely. So yes, I think you said it beautifully when you said we're given a test. But don't you think that if we had a teacher that, or someone who has already gone through that path and can tell us about the possibility of falling into this kind of temptation, then do you think that that might help people start out with an intention that may suit, their needs without leading them into temptation?
It makes sense, Roberta, but I would want to have a guide who would take somebody through Prozac, too. I would want a guide to take, we're going to go to Effexor, we're going to talk about those drugs. I want a guide who's going to sit with a person and say, okay, now this is going to relieve your depression for now, but here's what we're going to look for. We're not going to look for you just to get relaxed and get sloppy. We're going to look for you to get relaxed, not be as depressed, and now let's explore your mind. So I think wherever there's a substance, it would be fabulous if they're a guide. But usually, what do? Give them the substance, tell them to come back next week, I'll give them another nickel bag.
Right.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little music, and we'll continue. First came out, you know what I heard?
What?
Lucy is this guy with diamonds. I really thought they were asking a question. Lucy is this guy with diamonds. Meaning, is this guy bringing you diamonds, Lucy? It took many years. But I guess it was what I was smoking. What we learned is that the Beatles, of course, were very pro-mind expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And they sure brought that to people.
And it seems like a lot of famous people, I mean, scholars, you know, not junkies. I mean, people with culture, education, money and power and intelligence have been in favor of mind expansion.
Well, talk about when the first ships came to America.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Tierra del Fuego, down in Argentina, the tribes down there had never seen a boat or a ship. And so when the conquistadores, when the colonizers were on their way in to the shore of the Tierra del Fuego, the people who had never seen ships did not see the ships because their minds could not conceive of a house on a boat that floats
on
water.
Right.
On water. So their minds could not go there, therefore their eyes did not see the boats. The only people, the only members of tribes that saw the ships were the shamans. Why? Because the shamans' minds were used to being expanded into realms and regions where things would be uncommon, unexpected, surprising, and where they would see things that they had never seen. So their minds were ready for surprise, and therefore it was possible to see the ships. But for someone who had not had that opportunity to stretch their mind, I guess it's like a muscle. If you stretch your muscles become flexible. If you don't stretch them, they tighten up and shorten and they become more narrow. And the same thing seems to happen with the mind.
A word here for posit science and that brain program I'm using.
Mm.
And, you know, it's
sure.
Just amazing that now we have a way without chemicals. You could actually, using your computer, you could just push your brain cells a little bit and move them around.
Definitely.
But how did we get there? How did we even get to the idea? I'm sure somebody who started this was a stoner. I'm sure. I tell you, it's a...
I believe, Armand, that it's innate in every human being, because as we grow and develop, we want to incorporate more things into our consciousness. So there is an innate instinctual drive to expand limits of awareness. I also believe, let's take addiction. What is addiction? Well, every addict or alcoholic or someone who falls into that trap starts out doing what? Trying something that hopefully will make one feel better and maybe even expand his or her mind
and
a bit.
And what does better mean? Better means get out of your rut.
Right, get
right?
out
I mean,
of the...
I mean, it's mostly to get out of the condition you're in.
Definitely.
Because you don't like what you're in.
Let's say you can't travel, you don't have the money, you're a kid, you're locked up in the house,
you hate
you
your
have
parents
homework
because
to do.
You got...
Maybe you live in an abusive home and you're just sick of it.
And you got a bag of glue. You got glue, you put it in a bag, you notice if you smell the glue, right?
Oh, my God. That makes me sad.
I know, but you notice if you smell the glue, everything disappears.
Right.
I remember the one man I had in here. I had a young boy in here once when we were doing a cocaine rehabilitation program. Kid comes in, is doing crack, and he says, look, my mother's a prostitute. He says, I have no idea who my father is. My mother's on the street selling her body. He said, when I do crack, when I take a puff of crack, all of that disappears.
Yeah.
He said, can you give me anything that's better than that? He says, can all of your psychology help that disappear in my mind?
Right.
And that's the problem. Well, you know, let's just talk about these drugs, for example, just because you don't know. You know, Coca-Cola used to be a real drug.
Definitely.
I mean, it still is. It's a potent substance now, but...
Yeah, but nowhere near what it used to be.
It used to have... What was in it? It was
cocaine.
Cocaine, right. It was a coca leaf squeezed into a thing, and that was the essence of it. It was quite a nice thing. I get curious about some of these things that people use because, you know, when the humans get their hands and start shaping things, you never know what you're going to do when you shape them. For a minute, I'd like to talk about marijuana. Now, marijuana, there's a big debate about medical use of marijuana. Is there such a thing as medical use of marijuana? Well, Roberta, you've seen it live, right?
I am totally sold on the concept because when I was working with the children at the Child Life at GMHC, families affected by AIDS, these kids were given drugs, antivirals and other medications that were so powerful, so strong, that the kids would stop eating. They would lose their appetite completely, and they would become anorexic, and they would lose a lot of weight, and they'd become so thin. And the only thing that would get them to eat again was the THC, the marijuana. It was given in the form of a pill. They would get the munchies, just like anyone who smokes it gets the munchies. And they would start eating again, and that was a lifesaver, Armand.
We learned since that there is a center of the brain called the cannabinoid receptor, which is specifically there. And the cannabinoid receptor responds to THC, tetrahydrocannabinoid, which is the chemical that's in marijuana that gets you high. THC, this cannabinoid receptor of yours, when it's turned on, it turns off your thing that tells you you've eaten too much, so you get munchies and you don't stop eating.
And that was a lifesaver for those kids.
They would eat. Now, a company in France discovered that they invented a pill that will actually turn off that cannabinoid receptor, because it turns out in people who are very overweight, the cannabinoid receptor is broken, and so they eat endlessly. So now they found a pill called Acomplia, which was therefore, it's not legal in America, which is stopping people from eating endlessly.
It's amazing.
Not because they're filled, but they found a way of turning off that switch, and that was all discovered through medical research. Marijuana, once again, let's go back to it. Used for glaucoma. Why? Why glaucoma?
Because glaucoma, the problem with glaucoma is that it builds up a lot of pressure in the eye, and the pressure damages the delicate texture of the blood vessels in the eye, and eventually leads to corrosion, and the eye kind of disintegrates. And marijuana lowers the blood pressure, thereby relieving the symptom and slowing down the progression of glaucoma.
It also relieves nausea.
Mm-hmm,
in
sure.
cancer, it's used to relieve nausea, and it's like the only relief, and it works to multiple sclerosis. It helps control some of the seizures.
Not to mention as an anti-anxiety, as a sleeping aid, you know, to control post-traumatic stress disorder. And most of all, Armand, the way that all these substances, including marijuana, have shown the greatest results is when they were used in conjunction with therapy.
Yeah.
Because with therapy, now you have a human interaction and the aid of the substance enlisted under the guidance and the cooperation of another human being who knows how to do it. That's a recipe for success.
And that's the problem with almost all chemicals. All chemicals, and Roberta, you know, you more than anybody else I know are with this, because when you're a nutritionist or a doctor and you prescribe a chemical to a person and then you say to the person, take this chemical and then check with me if you have any problems, but you're as a doctor, forget about it. Or a nutritionist who gives a person a nutritional regimen and then you don't even remember who they are, which is, I mean, it goes with the turf if you're going to handle so many people. The problem is that you can't remember who the people are and that there's no follow-through. And at the very beginning, people have reactions that are questionable. And if they had a guide, if they had Roberta there, or they had a doctor there, or, you know, I take photographs of people so I could remember their faces, you know.
And the problem, Armand, is in reverse from my position, is that people are so, by now, used to getting the pill and that's it, that they don't understand how important it is to follow up, because not everybody's going to respond the same way to the same substance. And to have that dialogue is part of what gives you the best odd to succeed.
Absolutely.
In anything that involves a chemical. Anything.
You know, I find that people find it hard to believe. A lot of people consult with me, Roberta, and I will send them to somebody for something. If they consult with me for a physical disorder, I'll send them to a physical thing. But I say, you must call me within a week.
Yeah.
You must send me an email. If I send them to therapy, I say, send me an email in 2 weeks. I want to know exactly what's going on. Then write me another one in 2 more weeks after that. They don't think I mean it. They don't think I care. But there's a part of me that feels responsible for people, and I want to follow up. Maybe the formula was not right. Maybe the prescription wasn't right. Mm-hmm. Maybe something is going wrong.
And Armand, any time any person seeks any kind of healing, this is my belief, whether it's healing for the body or for the mind, well, it's an inner journey in the sense that you're going to have to find something within yourself that you don't have at the moment, right? If you're sick, there's a missing piece, whether it's missing information, missing functionality, missing something. So whenever you go and seek some kind of healing, whatever that might be, you are bound to find some expansion of your mind and of awareness, consciousness. You're bound to find it no matter what you seek.
And if the problem is, if you seek something that has no potential follow-up, you know, if you get something,
that's where things could go wrong.
That's
sure.
Where you've got to be in trouble.
I think one of the most dangerous things that anyone could do is to go without guidance into their unconscious, head first, you know, dive in there and find out what's there. No, wait a minute, because once you're down there, what's down there is not even the personal stuff. There is all the stuff that all the culture brings with it, the archetypal structure. I mean, dangerous things could be down there, and if you don't know how to, you know, you don't dive without first getting a diving license, or without
Excuse
first...
I mean, almost.
Bell, I
almost,
mean...
Almost, without a diving
works.
Bell. Without,
You need oxygen to go down
but
there.
But I'll tell you, Roberta, I don't think it's as dangerous.
I do.
I know you do.
I do.
But I think you don't get the benefits. And
No, wait a minute. I think it's necessary for people to investigate their unconscious. I think that's something that... I would make it mandatory in school. I think it's the only way, actually, to really liberate oneself, but not without caution and not without guidance.
Let's talk a little bit about some of these things that happen to us when we experiment a little bit. I want to talk about marijuana, and I want to talk to a lot of people who find marijuana a recreational drug. Okay, now I want to talk about this because there's something here that I've noticed and I've seen. Marijuana used to be a substance that was grown as a plant, and it was grown in Colombia somewhere, and you'd get this, or in Mexico, and you'd get it. And you would smoke it, and you would get some kind of high from it. Then they took this very chemical, and they said, oh, let's make it better. And so they started refining the seeds, and they got only the best seeds, and they grew only the best seeds. And then the government countered by spraying all the plants with some kind of poison. And, pardon me. And so, but then this idea came up. Let's refine marijuana. Let's refine it. And the idea came up about a thing that was called sensimilla. Now, I want to describe sensimilla. If you take a marijuana plant and you stress it, that means if you make it think it's dying, the thing the plant does is it puts out flowers. It sends out flowers because it wants to, the flowers are an invitation to a pollen to come along and seed it so that it would be developed some kind of a seed so that it would start having babies. Because what happens when you stress a plant, the plant thinks, how will I have babies before I die? Because that's my job.
Right. Well, that would be normal for any living organism. It's instinctual and an innate response to the threat of imminent death.
So then they figured out, well, if we stress it enough, if we give it no water, it's going to put out more flowers. And now if we give out, if we bend it, they espalier the plants, mm-hmm. they bend the plants, we're going to choke it, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Choke right. off its water, and it puts out even more flowers. And then we'll frustrate it. We'll make sure there are no male plants around to seed this female plant.
Mm-hmm.
So they kill all the males. As soon as a male shoot comes up, you could recognize it, they kill it. So here's this female plant who is choking, who is starving, who is thirsty, who is dying. And she knows she's going to die, the sensimilla plant, the marijuana plant. And she sends out flowers. And flowers saying, please, please, some passing pollen, seed me before I die. And then if that's not good enough, she sends out this sticky substance. And it becomes very sticky, maybe a little pollen, and I could just catch it. And they get very sticky flowers. And these flowers, which are called buds, are very, very valuable because they have the highest concentration of this THC. You can get the most concentration from this frustrated female. And then the moment the people who watch the plants, sometimes they just can't stop a pollen from passing by. A pollen gets on the plant, and the minute they see a seed, the minute they see that the plant has gotten a mate, they cut off its neck and they kill it.
Mm.
So here you have this dead female who has been frustrated all of her life, who has put out flowers, who never got a chance to procreate.
Now,
and here's what happens. I'm sorry, let me just finish the story. Now they bag it, and they dry it. They hang it by its neck, and they let it dry out. And here you are, these dried out flowers are sold for $1,000 each or something, some huge amount of money. And people smoke them, and they get high from them. But here's what I've noticed. I've noticed that people who smoke this sensimilla have very funny minds. Their minds seem to be the minds of somebody who's like a dying female over and over again. So
that's very interesting. I do believe that when people take these substances that come from plants, there is a mingling of spirits, but that's because I believe in spiritual world. Some people don't believe in spirit, so they would justify that through chemistry. But I do believe you take on the essence of whatever it is that you use. And so I would think that when you combine a powerful substance that comes from a plant with powerful greed, you have mm-hmm. an explosive combination there that in my opinion, is not going to lead to anything good.
Well, you know, the coca leaf, Roberta, originally was just a coca leaf.
Right.
No. You'd chew it. Gorillas used to chew it. You know, people would chew it.
Sure. Well, in South America, you can get a cup of tea made from coca leaves because the tea itself is not that powerful. It's not. It's like a cup of tea. It's not going to make you high. But then you can turn that into
crack,
and that's
and that process.
But that's exactly the plant plus greed, because I think that and greed there becomes so exorbitant that it actually really creates a poison. So I think it's nothing is good or bad, but I think that the more powerful something is, the more dangerous it could be, or the more potentially
beneficent.
What's the word?
Good.
The more it could be gooder.
Beneficial. Okay. So,
beneficial. Thank you.
So, but you know, heroin. Somebody looked at the Bayer Corporation.
Bayer Fabriken.
The Bayer aspirin people,
right?
They came along and they said, you know, morphine is addictive. We got to be careful. We're going to beat this. We're going to invent heroin.
You know that initially they marketed it to women, housewives, and it was marketed in a syrup. And they would market it saying, you know, you're at home by yourself and you're feeling a little tired or blue. Here, take a teaspoon of this. And that was heroin. It was really interesting.
I found a bottle of it. There was a physician I know who died. He was 100 years old or something. And I looked at his cabinet and there was this bottle of heroin syrup.
Hmm.
You know, and there were other things that they had. They used to have morphine suppositories. And
well,
but you see, what they did again here, Roberta, is they took this thing, the poly, the poppy seed,
right
from a poppy, and the humans converted it and made it potent and made it powerful.
Yeah, that's really where you end up with a troubling situation. But certainly, that does not mean that the plant itself or the substance is bad. In fact, you know, Armand, personally, I wish there was more research being done using these substances, what should we call them?
Mind-altering?
Well, mind, but more than mind-altering. I'm talking about substances like the ones that comes from mushrooms or like LSD that really expand perception. Those, not so much opium or cocaine. I wish there was more research done with that because my belief is, just from what I've seen, even historically, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, people would use these substances to have mystical experiences and to intensify their connection with the divine, to become more aware of the divine aspects of human existence. Well, why can't we focus on the positive that can be gotten from utilizing these substances in a benevolent way? I wish there was more of that. I wish that someone like you, Armand, could benefit from having something legal on your desk and that when you deem it appropriate, you could say to a client, a patient, you know what, I think this might help us get to where we need to go.
You know, the trouble with it is, Roberta, once you get that kind of a thing, you get to believe your own stuff. If I believe that it's a good substance, I might actually, like so many people I know who are recommending St. John's Wort, you get to believe in it. And you get to believe this is what I should sell, and now you sell pills with your own, you know, you just...
No, that's not what I envisioned. That was not my envisioning.
Yeah, it
was different, but...
The problem is you get to believe your own stuff. You always got to have checks on it. Well, I thank you so much, Roberta, because you're... certainly not one to eat the Jimson weed. Jimson weed?
What is that?
Jimson weed, belladonna.
Oh.
Belladonna comes from Jimson weed, the first original common weed. Hey, this is Armand DeMille. Remember, we're still looking for volunteers who are students of psychology or social work or mental health to help us in a project that we're doing. You can get us at 212-757-4488. You can look at Roberta's new website or Roberta's website.
Well, my website is creativehealthsolutions.org, but I am creating a website with information for people with herpes, and it's called Herpes Be Gone.
Thank you, Roberta. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun.